you so much for your precious time. This is the Critical Care Commute podcast, where we talk to the widest range of experts relevant to acute care medicine. This is Peter Brindley, a critical care physician, somewhat opinionated, hopefully just the right side of provocative, professor at the University of Alberta Hospital.
And I'm Leon Baker, the unlikely introverted podcaster and critical care physician working out in the community in Edmonton, Canada. By the way, you can claim continuous professional development points for these. Go check out your local college's website.
Step-by-step instructions for the Canadians on the website.
Yesterday, Julie Crum, neurointensivist from the wonderful, shall I say this is an Edmontonian, wonderful city of Calgary and the University of Calgary. And you know what, Leon, do a proper bio. That wasn't a proper bio.
All right. Well, so thanks for joining us, Dr. Julie Crum, intensivist neurologist working at the Rocky View General Hospital and Foothills Medical Center in Calgary. Of course, dual trained in neurology and critical care medicine, and also fellowship trained in neurocritical care. And no better person to talk to on this very difficult landscape of neuroprognostication after cardiac arrest. This is something that we're revisiting today. Peter, what has it been about a year since we spoke to Gord Boyd on this?
It has indeed, but it's an incredibly important topic for our specialty. It's worth a second look.
Absolutely. Not only very important, but also riddled with traps and difficulties, which we would love to dive into. So stay tuned as we revisit neuroprognostication and as we delve into the how-tos, the pitfalls, balancing, nihilism with false hope.
I think you just did, actually, Leon. So yeah, I think we should dive into some cruel questions for a guest that can more than take it. And by the way, a visiting professor just very recently up to Edmonton.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll jump straight in. During your talk in Edmonton at our grand rounds as the visiting professor, it was clear that you are rather passionate about neuroprognostication after cardiac arrest. I'm sure there's a story there. Julie, tell us a bit more. How did you become so passionate about this?
Yeah. First off, thanks, Leon. Thanks, Peter, for inviting me to be involved in this. It's great to have the opportunity to talk about something that's so near and dear to my heart. And a little bit intimidating to follow Gord, because listen to his podcast, and he did an exceptional job with you guys.
It was rubbish. It was terrible.
To answer your question, I think, you know, when I became an attending, I became so impressed with how, you know, the buck stops with you. And I think that was even more powerful when it came to the world of neuroprognostication, because there's just not a great deal of guiding evidence for a lot of the conditions. I think we're relatively fortunate with post-arrest literature that's been growing exponentially over the years to help guide us, but less so with other disorders like traumatic brain injury, subarachnoid hemorrhage. And so I found myself having all of these consults that were really going to like change the lives of these people. And I felt very ill-prepared, even though I had spent innumerable years training. And so that really pushed me to dig into the literature. And then I was also fortunate enough to be asked to lead at least the electrophysiology section for the new Canadian physician statement that also afforded me the opportunity to really dig into some of this literature. So that's kind of how I ended up gaining all the knowledge that I was able to ascertain.
Yeah, indeed, the bug often does stop with us. We find ourselves making life-changing decisions, as you mentioned. If I may be a bit cheeky, are we just not one of the biggest risk factors for death after cardiac arrest and ischemic brain injury?
I mean, in a way, we kind of are. So, you know, 60 to 90% of patients, depending on the study that you look at, post-arrest will die as a result of withdrawal of life-sustaining measures due to a perceived poor prognosis. And it's not surprising that for patients who remain altered or comatose, they have a 50% increased risk of having withdrawal of life-sustaining measures compared to those who do start to show semblances of consciousness. And I'm not saying that that's not necessarily inappropriate, because there are going to be a lot of patients post-arrest who do have a poor outcome, and we need to be mindful of what their wishes are and help guide their management accordingly. But I do think keeping that in mind helps us be mindful of the fact that, you know, we do need to keep an eye out for patients who do have the potential to have a good outcome and not withdraw too quickly and give people what I often refer to for families, the benefit of the doubt. You know, mm-hmm. they deserve a little bit more time. They deserve the benefit of the doubt. Even though I might be concerned they have a poor prognosis, we should at least give them the benefit of the doubt.
And that's, of course, what this talk is about, the establishing this prognosis. What are the major pitfalls you would warn us against?
So I'd say the major pitfalls are kind of what I refer to in my talk up at U of A as kind of the foundational pillars, or what I use as foundational pillars for myself. And so the first one I talk about is kind of first do no harm. And that's just that fine line we walk as physicians in really everything we do, in balancing, you know, both the self-fulfilling prophecy that comes into play for patients that we're neuroprognosticating, but then also the risk of providing families with false hope and the harm that that can cause. Probably one of the biggest pitfalls that we run the risk as healthcare providers falling into would be what I often tell people to do is look beyond the fog. And what I mean by that is excluding confounders. I think actually as a healthcare community, we need to be better at defining what those confounders are. We did a national survey recently and found that there was minimal agreement amongst people on what should be considered a confounder of both the neurological exam, but also electrophysiological studies like EEG and SSEPs. So I'm always very mindful when prognosticating patients to make sure that, you know, they're relatively hemodynamically stable, they're not hypercarbic, they're not profoundly hypoxemic, mm-hmm. their electrolytes are, you know, relatively within, you know, normal limits. They have good renal function, liver function. And if not, I do my best to try and remedy all of those. I'm also very mindful about sedatives or things that the patients could have taken that could have contributed to their cardiac arrest, making sure that I'm certain that those cleared out of their system. And another pitfall that I think we run the risk of, and even I gave examples in my talk of patients that I did this to, and it's lacking humility or running the risk of being overcome by some of our biases. And there's a great amount of literature that's evolving in this about all the biases that exist in neuroprognostication, like confirmation bias, availability bias, bandwagon effect, one of my favorite ones. You see in the chart always like poor prognosis, and then it gets mm-hmm. cut and pasted all the way through the patient's care. So those are things that we always have to be mindful of as well, I'd say.
Brilliant. So first, do no harm. Look beyond the fog. Love that. And be humble. Try and check your biases at the door, I guess. So with that, I'd like to pivot then to the two main pillars in my view, or legs, if you will, of neuroprognostication. One being the clinical exam, and then of course the other one being special testing. So in brief, I guess the clinical exam, in your view, what are the best clinical exam findings? When should we do them? When should we believe them?
Yeah, great question. So it's interesting to read some of the literature around the neurological exam and how it's evolved even when I was a resident to now. So I remember when I was a resident, you know, motor exam was really important. The pupillary light reflex was really important. The corneal reflex was really important. And now we're finding, you know, even the pupillary light reflex can have a wide false positive range, anywhere up to 32%. The corneal reflex as well, the false positive range can vary between 4 to 10%. And the motor score, the false positive range is, you know, astronomically and unacceptably high now. It's up to like 53 to 81% in some patients. So while I do believe, you know, a good thorough neurological exam that should be done daily is really important. And these can be informative if someone's lacking, let's say, a pupillary light reflex beyond 72 hours or the corneal mm-hmm. reflex is absent beyond 72 hours. I think those are helpful. But again, you still need to be really mindful that you don't have things that are confounding them or mm-hmm. giving you those findings. We know that the corneal reflex is actually the most sensitive reflex to sedatives. So I'm often quite mindful of, again, lingering effects of sedatives for patients. Mm-hmm. And the motor exam is something that I often don't use just given the high false positive rate that it has. But I am mindful in those kind of those patients that kind of fall in the gray zone where you're not really sure what their prognosis is and you're giving them more time, that as you let time pass after someone has had an arrest, the false positive rate for the motor score does improve with time. And so it does get a bit more reliable once you get into kind of week two, week three for these patients.
So this is not a 72-hour thing. This is, you're mentioning week two, week three, even for the motor exam.
Definitely for the motor exam. I wouldn't use it earlier. Like, I wouldn't use it within the first week, to be honest with you. Certainly with, not within the first 3 days.
So we were talking off air a little bit earlier. I'm a community guy. I work at the Greyhounds Hospital. It sounds like it would be safe to say that at 72 hours, the pupillary response and corneal reflex, those are fairly good indicators of a poor prognosis?
Yeah, fairly good, especially if both of them are absent together. That's even more reliable, understandably so. And we care so much about these two reflexes because they fall so close to specific nuclei within the brainstem that are responsible for consciousness. So people can assume that if these nuclei are damaged and these reflexes aren't present, then it's likely that other nuclei in such close proximity are also damaged. Mm-hmm. But again, just being mindful that there's no confounders that are potentially causing those findings is really important, even beyond 72 hours.
All right. That brings us then to special testing, EEG, SSEP, CT, MRI. What should I know as a community guy?
So I guess the way I think about special tests is I kind of break them down into three categories. You have your neuroimaging, you have your electrophysiological tests, and then you have your biomarkers. Biomarkers are probably the easiest to talk about first off because we all unfortunately don't really have great access to them. We found in our national survey that there's a very small proportion of people across Canada that have access to biomarkers. And as a result, these are not often used within at least the Canadian healthcare system to prognosticate patients. But certainly there's a lot of literature evolving around ton of different biomarkers that may be helpful in the future. And the old school neuron specific enolase that we used to use, and again, I remember learning about as a neurology resident, is actually not the most reliable from what we've now learned. There's a great review article or systematic review that was published by a Canadian group in JAMA Neurology, I believe, that showed that neuron filament light chain is probably the best so far with the literature we have. So I think that's one for people just to kind of keep an eye on and stay tuned as the literature evolves. And hopefully we'll get some more tests that can help with prognosticating these patients and tests that are actually accessible to us in Canada. For neuroimaging, I guess your two options are CT scan or MRI. I always start with CT scan first. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because the CT heads are more specific. If you do find that there is a drop in your gray-white ratio less than 1.15, which is actually quite easy to measure just on impacts for us or any other system, you just kind of divide the Hounsfield unit of the gray matter in a variety of different areas. I often use the caudate nucleus by the Hounsfield units that are averaged in the white matter for, again, you can use a variety of different areas, but I often use the posterior limb of the internal capsule. And if it's less than 1.15, then that is quite specific for poor prognosis.
Is this something that is generally reported?
No, it's unfortunately not. This is something that I would love to help implement, whether it's just in our center or, you know, provincially or even nationally. But I think what we need to get better at as a healthcare system is actually having more objective reporting that reports things that have actually been published on in the literature. Often you're going to see your CT report says there's gray-white blurring, and they don't often specify the severity. We find the same thing with EEG, that sometimes they'll just say, well, there's slowing that suggests that there's a cerebral injury, and people just assume, oh, that means that there's hypoxic ischemic brain injury. This is a poor prognosis. So I do think we need to be a bit more objective in reporting them. But until that point, it is relatively easy to learn how to do it yourself.
And that brings us to MRI then.
Yeah. So for MRI, MRI is great, in my opinion, when your CT scan doesn't give you an answer. So if your CT scan is quite underwhelming, unremarkable, you still have to be mindful that it has pretty low sensitivity. So you still can't rule out a large burden of brain injury. And that's where the MRI can become quite helpful. Generally, the MRI you want to do a little bit later than CT. So a lot of the literature on CT looks between 48 to 72 hours. Versus MRI, kind of your window that you want to do it in is going to be between 48 to 168 hours, or like out to 7 days. Because if you do it too early, you may actually not see any of the hypoxic ischemic brain injury. And actually, if you do it too late, you can get what's called pseudonormalization, where the scan will potentially start to look more and more normal. So I do like to be mindful of the timing of the MRI, and that can be helpful again because it's more sensitive than CT. If you don't see anything on your CT, you may still get evidence of a large burden of hypoxic ischemic brain injury on MRI.
So practically speaking, CT at about 48 hours and MRI, what, day five?
Yeah, I'd say probably day three to five. It's probably pretty good timing.
And then electrophysiological testing.
Yes, this is my area of passion.
Oh, yeah.
So your two options are EEG and then evoked potentials. So evoked potentials essentially just test the integrity of your dorsal column lemniscal pathway. So we put electrodes on either the median or the ulnar nerve. It's usually the median nerve. And then place electrodes along the path that is going to be conducted all the way to the brain. And we essentially just record the potentials as that signal passes underneath the electrodes. And based on the literature, if you have bilaterally absent N20 potentials, which is essentially just the potential that's generated by the cerebral cortex saying, oh, someone has given me a painful stimuli. Mm-hmm. If those are bilaterally absent, that's probably one of the strongest tests we have to predict a poor prognosis. But unfortunately, again, based on the survey that we did, it's a test that not a lot of people in Canada have access to, mm-hmm. which is one of the inequities in our healthcare system, unfortunately. So it's not used as often, but it is something that I keep in my tool belt for specific patients if I am still not certain about what their prognosis is going to be.
And what about the timing of SSEP?
Yeah, so a lot of the guidelines recommend, it used to be beyond 72 hours. A lot of the articles or the literature is now suggesting that even an absent early on is suggestive of a poor prognosis with a low false positive rate, including within 24 hours. The position statement that we published really advised against using it within 24 hours because one thing that people aren't aware of is that they're not perfect. People often say, well, evoked potentials are not confounded like EEG is, but they actually are. So high doses of narcotics, high doses of propofol, benzodiazepines can all increase your latencies or reduce the amplitude of the potentials. And then if you compound that with, like, let's say you have shivering artifact or other issues that you just have to battle when you're doing these studies too early, you can cause a false positive. So we advised using them beyond 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. And EEG.
Yeah, EEG, I think, has huge potential for helping to prognosticate these patients because evidence is suggesting that it can be helpful to predict a poor prognosis, but also there's things on the EEG that may give you a clue that, I think this patient needs more time. They have the potential to have a good outcome. So the things that have been consistently showed to suggest a poor prognosis for patients are if the EEG just shows severe suppression, which again has to meet very specific voltage criteria that unfortunately aren't often objectively reported in our national reports or the way people report them. But if it's suppressed, if you have burst suppression, and burst suppression, actually we've now divided into synchronous burst suppression where your bursts are like very angry, they have like epileptiform abnormalities within them. That's highly predictive, even if it's within 24 hours from the arrest. And then non-synchronous burst suppression, where your bursts are less angry, they're kind of the bursts that we can actually cause just with sedation. That also is predictive of a poor prognosis, again, so long as you've ruled out that there are no confounders causing that burst suppression. And then lastly, if you have generalized periodic discharges, which again, just look like discharges on the EEG, or kind of like a QRS on the EEG. And as long as those are on a very, very flat background, that's also predictive of a poor prognosis. Versus if you have like a continuous background, there's maybe some reactivity, people comment on like there's normal organization or like a posterior dominant rhythm. Those are the EEGs that kind of reassure me and tell me, oh, I actually think this patient has the potential to have a good outcome. We need to give them more time just to wake up.
I'm going to jump in now, if I may, and tip over the apple cart with love and affection, if you don't mind. For the average doc out there, I obviously don't want to withdraw on anyone prematurely or give up on people who have a chance, but I am very concerned about how we do this. And I worry that we've now made this 72-hour plus I don't know, a totem. You must keep going for all this time, regardless of whether the patient's in status myoclonus with no brainstem findings and a history very clear that they were down for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours with a tattoo that said DNR on their chest, and they came into the emergency room already still in asystole and people kept going, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It worries me that we do a lot of these tests almost to fill the delay, and then we ignore them, even though they're bad prognosticators, and give them yet more time. And they almost become cover our ass tests rather than help the patient once. If we look at Leon, I mean, he can't get SSEPs. We can't get the biomarkers. The EEGs, we're never quite sure what to do with, unless, as I say, they show the horrendous things that you've talked about. But even the, does this patient have a seizure? Is it a de novo seizure versus is it just a sign of how beaten up the brain is? Oh, and I guess the sedatives are the last thing. Yes, there's residual sedatives, especially if you've cooled a patient. But sedatives such as opiates would make your pupils small, not big. And so you've got a patient there with no brainstem findings, fixed dilated pupils, and a terrible history. Do we truly, don't worry, this is coming to a question, not a mini lecture. 72 hours is the minimum, is it? Is there anyone you can stop on confidently prior to 72 hours?
Yeah, so I think that this has evolved in a way just because of the way that studies are designed. And I can appreciate why people design studies the way they do to look at neuroprognostication of these patients. But I agree with what you're suggesting, Peter. And I will say that personally, I've had patients where I am confident based on just neuroimaging and a very malignant EEG that they're going to have a very poor prognosis even before 72 hours. And I think there's a lot of factors that don't really get incorporated into the guidelines and the studies that are equally, if not more important, that have to go into this process or be considered in this process, including, you know, like, what's the age of the patient, their comorbidities, the circumstances of the arrest, even though, you know, people always argue that hasn't necessarily been shown to consistently predict a poor prognosis depending on initial rhythm and your downtime and whatnot, which I, again, appreciate.
Absolutely. And the vagaries of histories too, you know, they were pulseless for 20 minutes, 60 minutes, 3 hours. And it, as you say, it gets cut and pasted into the note and almost becomes believed as a pseudo.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I do think that there are a huge number of other things that are really important. Like, you know, what are the patient's beliefs, their experiences, their values, what wishes had they conveyed to their family? What was their quality of life even before the arrest? And were they happy even with that quality of life? Because even setting aside, you know, what I sometimes refer to as the mysteries of the brain and how we can't always be 100% certain about our prognostication, sometimes just sitting down and getting to know the patient through their family and appreciating who they are as a person and what they've conveyed to their family before sometimes gives you hard stops to begin with. And so those are the circumstances where I have stopped before 72 hours.
Thank you, Julia. It's a very nuanced answer. I'm going to keep going. It sounds like I'm sticking up for Leon more than I would in everyday life, let's be honest. I have the luxury of neurologists with a special interest in this topic. I can pick up the phone and call you. I can call Gord. The average neurologist, do they have special expertise in neuroprognostication of people on ventilators? And I do not mean this to sound mean or tribal, but I can't come close to a neurologist in terms of identifying where a neural lesion is or picking up on neuromuscular disease or, you know, all the incredible things that neurologists are trained for 5 years to do. But many of them don't have a great deal of experience in the ICU or patients on ventilators. They're being asked to see somebody whose brain has taken a hit, but that isn't really the sole bailiwick of neurology. I guess here's my question. Is it a de facto neurology consult on every such patient, or is it a neurology consult if you have doubt, or is it a neurology consult if you have the expertise that you or Gord or others have?
Yeah. So I will say that I learned more about neuroprognostication as a critical care fellow, getting schooled by my senior neuro ICU colleagues.
Schooled. I like the word.
I won't mention their names.
I hope it wasn't me in one of these similar polemics that I just had.
But yeah, I learned more as a critical care fellow than I did as a neurology resident. And I, again, as I mentioned at the start of this podcast, then learned even exponentially more as an attending than I did as a neurology resident or a critical care fellow. I think the most important thing for these patients, and again, I'm not discounting anything that neurologists do, because like they're brilliant people, like you were saying, you know, they manage MS and they can do so much more than I can actually do anymore, despite my baseline training. But I think the reason why neurocritical care has been proven to help patients and improve outcomes is because you have designed or developed a new area of specialists that actually have content, expertise, and passion for these patients that do sometimes fall through the cracks. So I think, you know, if you're uncertain as the most responsible healthcare provider for your patient, it's not necessarily that you should be asking neurology. I think we should be asking someone we know that actually has that content expertise. I recognize that that's easy for me to say as one of those people, and it's hard for people in community centers, but I think we need to develop as a healthcare system better ways in which people who are at regional centers can access, again, people who have that content expertise to help prognosticate these patients if they are also uncertain about things.
Which rolls us perfectly into the last thing we wanted to ask, which is about developing national expertise, about providing expertise to places that don't have that person in-house. So tell me about some of your interests in national links within neurocritical care, national rounds, national curricula. You run a superb, again, it pains me to say this, a superb neurocritical care fellowship down in Calgary. We haven't duplicated it in Edmonton yet. What can we do to sew together our 10 disparate provinces, 11 disparate provinces?
Yeah, I think we have huge potential. So I am very grateful for the fellowship that I was able to do in New York for a year. It was eye-opening. I got to meet some amazing people, develop great networks and people that I collaborate with, and learned a lot. And it was great to see a different healthcare system. But one of the things that I was so profoundly impacted by is the difference in how we do critical care in Canada and how they do critical care in the US. And it's not to say that one is better than the other. It's just to say they're different. The training I got in neurocritical care, as powerful as it was, and as useful as it was very neuro-focused, and it really didn't kind of integrate in a more comprehensive manner everything to do with the patient, because, you know, the heart is equally as important as the brain and the lungs and the kidneys and everything. And so I honestly think that we can train neurointensivists, Canadian neurointensivists, within a Canadian system. And I think we can train them to be great neurointensivists in Canada. And I think, you know, that was kind of the impetus that led to our creation of a fellowship in Calgary. And as I was developing that and talking with other people across the country, I started to learn that there's other programs who are wanting to make fellowships or have already started fellowships. And that got me thinking that, you know, to try and connect us even from an educational perspective, like there's now this group of us. It used to be just a handful of people when I was looking into becoming a neurointensivist in Canada. Like there's hardly any. And now there's this huge cohort across the country of neurointensivists. And I think to connect us in a way where we can all have, you know, monthly or every 2 months have like educational rounds or case discussions or topics that were discussed that are not just for the benefit of like fellows across the country, but also for the neurointensivists or other general intensivists that want to be involved or other subspecialized intensivists that want to be involved, I think can be hugely helpful, because it is a very nuanced area of ICU. And the more I can do to empower people, whether they're physicians, nurses, respiratory therapists, fellows, trainees, to appreciate those nuances and provide exceptional care for their patients, that's really my goal for my career.
Well, bravo to that. I think Canada's a perfect petri dish for this in that we have, I said 10 or 11 provinces, I included the territories as the extra one, but these vast distances that need to be provided for. We don't have that many medical schools, but at least they're of similar standards. And so expertise comes from all areas of the country. And, neurocritical care is a very fertile area for discussion. Cities are saying, do we need a dedicated neuro ICU or is it an offshoot of general systems? Versus people are saying, well, if we need continuous EEG, does it have to be in-house or with the bandwidth that's now available? You know, could we have prairie-wide continuous EEG? In other words, one person providing it for many places. So I think it could be a golden era for neurocritical care and actually another golden era for Canadian intensive care, because we do offer a bit of a lovely combination of generalism. Most of us aren't single organ doctors, and just enough centers to have plurality of opinion and not too many places that we get too territorial. Leon, I think Julie has done valiant work putting up with our questions. Any more questions, or is it time to let this poor lady get back to unpacking boxes at her glorious brand new house?
I have no further questions. This was awesome. Thank you so much for your time, Julie. Thanks for your expertise and sharing your insights.
Thank you, guys. It was great to be here.
The health information offered on the Critical Care Commute podcast and the resources available for download through the podcast and show notes is provided for general informational and educational purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the hosts, guests, or any individuals featured on this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the hosts or their employers.